Alan Maya, if you can wave, at their house, on the wall next to the dining table, there's a painting of a house. Have you seen it? That was the house Maya's mother grew up in. In the 1900s, Maya's Afi, her Icelandic grandfather, came to Canada at 18 years old when his father died. He eventually settled into the Icelandic community in Saskatchewan, north of Regina, met a girl, and settled down. They were living in a barn when his wife became pregnant with Maya's mom. He picked out and ordered a house from an Eaton's catalog. The house arrived like a package for shelves from IKEA, and he put the whole thing up in time for Maya's mom to arrive into the family. They would go on to have 11 more kids. When a friend of the McKays saw an old photo of that house, he painted it. Now, what went through your mind listening to Maya's story? You were probably not thinking, where can I get myself one of those catalog houses? They don't even sell those anymore. But maybe you thought about your family, your grandparents, where you came from, the house you grew up in, how you got to be where and who you are today because of things that happened, decisions people in your family made that put you onto a certain path. Because that's what stories do. We are in the part of the worship calendar when we're counting off the weeks to the end of the worship year, to the next Advent and Christmas, when a new cycle begins for us. And the Old Testament readings from the worship calendar have us in Genesis. Genesis, starting in chapter 12, tells some really old stories of Abraham's family, something like 4,000 years old if we count back the genealogy. This is almost as old as the pyramids in Egypt, back in a time when civilization has not yet an alphabet to write things down other than to scratch word pictures into stone walls or mud tablets. So most of these stories, like ancient stories in all indigenous cultures, started as folk tales told around campfires, passed from old men to younger men, always with the same words, told the same way every time about ancestors and forefathers. They're kind of like song lyrics, just the essential details delivered in words and rhythm designed to fit the word limits of human memory so they can root into the ears of each new generation the critical events and plot twists that form the memory and identity of a people. So reading Genesis is a lot like looking at other people's photo albums or looking at the painting of that house Maya's grandfather built. The purpose of these stories is not life lessons, not a textbook on how things ought to be done, especially when the storyteller often doesn't give any hint of whether something is good or bad or someone was right or wrong. Instead, the stories are meant to involve us so we can compare our lives with theirs, our experience with God with theirs. Maybe these people did what we would have done or not. We may agree with this or disagree with that, or we find ourselves asking questions about our lives because of something that happened to them. Because that's what stories do. They provoke thinking and reaction, interactions that enlarge our point of views and sense of possibilities. The stories in Genesis invite us to feel what those people felt, to see ourselves in their longings, to struggle with their choices, so we can fill in the blanks with our experiences, our thoughts and questions, because we can see ourselves where they were. We're even allowed to ask tough questions of God, questions we would have asked even if they didn't, questions that we're asking of God now because of things happening in our lives. Which is what's amazing about these old stories in Genesis. They don't read like guttural grunting of uncultured people in an ancient world with a very different normal than ours. Somehow, even with the economy and words and details, the storyteller gives us people and lives which feel as real and as relatable as anything happening to us today. Abraham and Sarah and the problems remind us of people and things we know. somehow we get these people more often than not, what they want, why they do what they do, how they struggle, and navigating the consequences of their decisions and actions. They wrestle with the same emotional complexities we do. Tensions over race, gender, class, desires, regrets, jealousy, fears, longings. We may or may not agree with them. We may or may not even like them. But they are like us. They are people doing the best they can to live in difficult circumstances, complex personalities caught in competing desires. And like us, they have dreams they wanted desperately to come true. Except sometimes having your dreams come true only brings new problems. We will be reading about Abraham over these 3 weeks. You can read his story in Genesis starting at the end of chapter 11, when his name was still Abram before God changed it. And if you do read it, think of Maya's picture or someone else's photo album and see what these images bring up for you about your story, your family, and your experience with God, things you may want to start a conversation with God about. There are 10 sections in Genesis. The creation story is section 1. Each section after is God interacting with the person and their line as a metaphor of God's relationship with the nation of Israel. Adam is prototype Israel in section 2 after the creation story. And by section 6, we get to Abraham, who was the son of someone called Terah. Terah was from Ur, some distant place that would become Babylon, the empire, which would trigger nasty memories for the people writing down the story into the Jewish Bible some 1,500 years after Abraham, the way Nazi Germany would trigger bad memories. Because the scribes were the surviving descendants of war. When Babylon invaded Israel and scattered the people in an exile as a way to eliminate their genome from the earth, they almost succeeded. In fact, this was probably a motivation to write down these stories, to preserve the history and identity on paper as a matter of survival. Babylon represented everything wrong with civilization, and they make some people want for a better, kinder, more looking out for each other way to live together, which is what God offered all through the Bible. What the historians writing these stories now were wanting again after exile. It's probably what Terah wanted too, why Abraham's dad at some point decided to start pitching his tents away from Ur a bit at a time in the direction of Canaan, the lush land by the Jordan River that would eventually be the home of Israel. Maybe Terah was wanting to get far away from the people and the politics or even the gods of his hometown. Same reason people from Britain 200 years ago decided to jump on a ship for a fresh start in the Americas. The reason some of us left the places where we were born to start over in this country. But for some reason, Terah gave up on Canaan partway. He got comfortable and settled for halfway and just parked his tent at a place called Haran, grew old, and died. And here, Abraham also grew old, well into our age of retirement, and should have been living out the last chapter of his days, being content and comfortable. But Abraham had one major regret. He would die never having had children. The closest thing he had to a son was his nephew Lot, whom he had taken in when Lot's dad died. I don't know if he tried to make Lot the son he never had, but somehow Lot stayed a nephew, still someone else's son, with whom Abraham seemed to have a strained relationship. So Abraham's line was going to end with him. And this is the unlikely beginning of Israel's story as a nation. God comes to a 75-year-old Abraham at some middle-of-nowhere place and makes him an impossible offer. Come away with me, and I will give you the land and the people to become a great nation. For those of us who came here as immigrants, was it hard? Coming to Canada and starting over, Moving was unimaginable in Abraham's time, according to Fleming Rutledge, who said this. It was almost inconceivable, more difficult for a man of ancient times to leave his roots than it would be for a young man today, when all young men are expected to leave home. For a man of Abraham's time, it was nothing short of crazy to set out from home for no economic reason just because God said so. But to me, Abraham also seems a bit naive. I'm going to say, if Abraham was a smarter man, if he was as smart as we are, he would have said no thank you. Things too good to be true typically turn out to be scams. Recently, someone posted a picture from a Nigerian newspaper, a picture of piles of money in a scammer's apartment when police broke down his door to arrest him. Some smart aleck wrote the caption, "For years, this person has been writing emails to people all over the world to find someone to share this money with." How many of these emails have you gotten? Abraham said yes to God without even asking to see some pictures of this real estate. And Abraham didn't sound like a particularly adventurous or brave man. At this point, I presume Abraham had other gods besides this one who claimed to be the one who made the universe. This one took credit for creating order from the primordial chaos, what the Jewish people call tohu bohu, which apparently is also an English word. It just all sounds too good to be true. And really, isn't Abraham too old to immigrate to start over on some virgin piece of land? So thanks but no thanks would have been a much more reasonable response. But it's not hard to guess his reason for saying yes, because perhaps at his age, he still very wants to have this kid he never had. And perhaps more than that, he was not yet satisfied with the life he's lived. However far-fetched, this was an offer to make his life dream come true, and there's no other dream, no other offers on the table. Do you have a dream that you still want to come true? Perhaps what Abraham heard in God's offer was hope. Besides the land and the people to make a nation more civilized than the one he knew, hope, the thing that gives someone a reason to get out of bed in the morning, and the feeling of possibilities that something might happen today to make the future better than what has been. So Abraham said yes and set off. He brought Lot, even though God said this offer was only for him, and not knowing that Lot would make much trouble for Abraham down the road. Chapter 15 says Abraham believed God and what God offered him. But how sure was Abraham's faith in God? Abraham had to wait 25 years for God to make good on this promise, which is a long time to wait for something. Is there something you're waiting a long time for? More than once, Abraham and his wife shared a laugh about God's offer, perhaps because it was crazy and improbable. Or were they just silly giddy that at their age, there was hope, the possibility of something new and good that would smash the most disappointing thing in their lives. How exciting, even if the odds were against them. But still, the wait was hard at times. When Abraham had to keep reminding God that he had yet to deliver on baby, the main event in their relationship. And like most of us, what do? When we get impatient and tired with waiting on God, we get busy making things happen on our own. Which is what Abraham does around year 10 after meeting God. He and Sarah hatch a series of plan Bs. Who can blame them? There's no baby yet, and Sarah is only getting older by the day. So first, Abraham, sensing time running out, he suggests to God he could make his head servant his heir. When God did get back to him, God says, "Not this guy. I have in mind your own flesh and blood. Count the stars," he told them. "That's how many descendants I will give you." And we're told Abraham took God at his word despite all the doubts he was having. But remember, old Abraham is just getting older. The promise of a flesh and blood heir is only getting more implausible with each passing day. And yet God's assurances are only getting more grand and more confident. Like when God reassures Abraham by asking him to set up for the mother of all binding contracts. They literally cut a contract by halving a bunch of animals. Death to the one who breaks oath is what the parties would swear to each other as they walk through the carcasses. Only God put Abraham to sleep, and then God walked through alone. That God would not hold a human to a promise that only God can keep. Which at the time when Genesis was written down into the Bible was the shred of hope people were holding on to as the survivors of war, as they surveyed the rubble of their country. That God was forgiving and kind and understanding, and the way that big talking God came through for their ancient ancestors. They need that God to keep that ancient promise and come through for them again. Finally, 25 years after God made Abraham a promise, a 90-year-old Sarah gave birth to their son. They laughed again, not a cynical laugh this time, but genuine joy and pleasure of the dream coming true. So they named their baby, Isaac, Laughter. Well, when was the last time you felt that happy? Isaac should have been the happy climax in Abraham's story, but instead, Isaac's arrival sets up a very sad moment for Abraham. Back when the waiting got hard, when Sarah decided it was up to her to help move things along, after all, God's offer was for Abraham to be a dad, there was no guarantee that she would be the mom. So she suggested doing what was common of the day for a couple needing an heir, something we still do. She engaged the help of a surrogate. Sarah instructed her husband to bed her chambermaid Hagar, an Egyptian servant girl. Sarah expected a sort of business transaction. Abraham comes to her tent, spends a few sessions with her maid, and then at some point the maid would bring them a baby, and then everybody back to their places. But what Sarah did not anticipate was that the young servant girl would start acting like a wife. Somebody, a member of the family instead of the nobody slave girl she was. Sarah did not like it. This new attitude she was getting from her maid. She complained to Abraham, and Abraham basically said, she's your maid, you deal with her. So Sarah began treating Hagar badly, and the abuse continued. So when Isaac was born, now that Sarah has her own baby, she no longer needed Hagar and her boy Ishmael, and Sarah wanted them gone. Jealousy and insecurity. We know what that feels like, don't we? And that's what led to the story today from Genesis 21. A horrible moment, even if the storyteller doesn't say so. Sarah told Abraham his son with Hagar was a threat to Isaac's inheritance. This distressed Abraham, we're told, so perhaps he was pacing and wringing his hands in his tent when God showed up and consoled him. And if we believe the storyteller, instead of talking Abraham out of it, God actually approved of the decision to send away Hagar and the 14-year-old Ishmael. What were you thinking, God, is my question. How often have we wanted God to intervene in a way we think is right, and he seems to do nothing? So Abraham, seemingly with God's blessings and God's promise to look after Hagar and Ishmael, Abraham comes to Hagar's tent, gives her a flask of water and a loaf of bread, and sends her off with her son into the wilderness to fend for themselves, which would have been a death sentence. But true to his word, God showed up when the water ran out, at the moment when things got grim for them. Hagar left a napping or unconscious Ishmael behind a shrub and walked some paces away, because she was sure Ishmael was going to die and she couldn't bear to watch. The storyteller says God heard her crying, sent an angel to her, reassured her, made a well appear next to her. So with God's help, Hagar and Ishmael made a life in the desert, and they became the ancestors to the Arab states. Ishmael means God hears. He got that name because this was not the first time Hagar cried and God heard her in distress and showed up. Back in chapter 16, back before Hagar knew she was pregnant, there was a day when Hagar couldn't take Sarah's abuse anymore and decided to run away. She was sitting somewhere crying, and God sent an angel to come looking for her with a message. Go back. Put up with Sarah for a bit longer. You're with child. I got your back. And then Hagar says this in 16:13, which I find incredibly moving. She gave this name to the Lord who spoke to her. You're the God who sees me. I have now seen the one who sees me. As we gather to worship this morning, are you seeing the one who sees you with the things you're carrying with you in your life? I know this particular movement because Hagar is the person with the least social status in this story. She was treated like a commodity to cook and clean and make babies, and then it's discarded at the moment when she is no longer needed. You heard of the glass ceiling for women in corporations, that some places will not give the top jobs to a woman? I recently learned there's something called glass cliff. This is when a struggling corporation hires a woman CEO so that when the company fails, they could blame it on the woman. Women are still regularly used and discarded today. But the storyteller seems to go out of his way to say that God sees everyone. Regardless of the world might devalue some people, everyone to God is chosen. Everyone is worthy of God's attention. God sees and hears everybody. And God intervenes, but perhaps not in the overwhelming, overbearing way we think. God stays involved, but he also steps back and lets things play out. Abraham didn't get a postcard every morning telling him exactly what was going to happen on that day and exactly how he was supposed to act and react. Instead, Abraham and Sarah and Hagar continue to have agency. They're free to choose and act as they knew best. And God sometimes helps them, sometimes he talks them out of something, and sometimes he just makes something good out of their bad choices. In the end, a lot of people came to be that wouldn't otherwise exist if God had not shown up and intervened. There's a lot of that in Genesis. How have you experienced God's intervention in your life? 800 years ago, the Song Emperor in China sent word to my ancestor and asked him to pack up and move to the western province of China to work an official post. He did as he was ordered, and that's how my family ended up in the village where my grandfather was born. But as a teenager, when his father died, my grandfather left his village to make a life. Along the way, he learned a trade, welding, ended up in Hong Kong, and built a few businesses making and fixing ships. I'm now older than my grandfather was when he died. I never met him. From time to time, I wonder how my life would have been different, how I would be different if he lived and we got to have a relationship. One day I said this out loud, and my mom said, "Oh, then you wouldn't exist." When my grandfather died, my dad and his older brother had moved to Beijing for college. My dad was studying architecture, and my uncle had just started a career as a teacher. And according to my mom, they had no plans to come back to Hong Kong, where their parents were, and where his dad had his businesses. So I have questions. Like, were they trying to get away from home? From whom? Their mom or their dad? But there's no one who wants to answer these questions. When my grandfather died, there was a travel ban. So my dad and my uncle had to apply for special papers to come home for the funeral. That's when my grandmother confiscated the travel papers and they couldn't get back to Beijing. And so that's how my dad one day saw my mom's picture at a friend's house and made his move. If my grandfather didn't die, I wouldn't exist. And if it weren't for God, Israel wouldn't exist. Abraham's story would end with him, and Hagar and Ishmael would have perished in the desert. There's a lot of blessing talk beginning with Abraham in Genesis. And perhaps the Christian definition of blessing is something good that happened that wouldn't have happened if God didn't do something. And perhaps fine print number one is that a blessing may not appear to be a good thing at first by our estimation. But in time, God shows us how he can make good come out of something we don't like or welcome. What is significant about blessings or the blessing talk in Abraham's family story is that this is the first time we have blessing talk in Genesis since the curses language at the end of Adam and Eve's story when they chose to cut God out of their lives. That when God took the initiative to repair his relationship with humans, he brought with him blessings. If we believe God created us, then certainly we would not exist if God made a different choice than to make us and the cosmos. But perhaps some of our lives would be different if God didn't endow us with the blessings of gifts and abilities and people and significant relationships, opportunities and closed doors. And our paths would have been different if God didn't intervene with ideas and nudges and corrections, all the while as he allows us the freedom to forge our own destinies. We see all these things at play in Abraham's story, and they are, I think, at play in ours. That because of God, God with us, and God loves us, our lives are what they are in ways that would not have been if not for God. So I hope Abraham's story gives you something to talk to God about this week. And maybe God reminds you of a memory that you want to share with each other to further enlarge our sense of possibility. This is a Kate Bowler's prayer called A Blessing for When You Might Not Know How to Pray or Want to Pray. Bless are you in this terrible, wonderful now, fumbling around for the right words. You need so much and it seems impossible to say it all. Bless are you for whom prayer feels hopeless, disappointing, futile. Bless are you in your radical honesty, in the ways you speak of your grief, the long sleepless nights in a still empty bed, or the physical pain you feel, the joints that don't work as they used to, the brain fog, or chronic migraine, who speak of your loneliness, the empty home, or nest, or womb. Blessed are you who have the audacity to ask for the miracles you need, the healing, or a new friend, or a redeemed family. Blessed are you as you learn to trust. Trust a God who hears, who listens, who hasn't left your side, who prays on your behalf, interpreting those deep groans you can't quite put into syllables or sounds. Blessed are you as you settle into acceptance. And blessed are you who live here in the someday, but not now. Amen.